So we are in Boston with George Daly, who's director of the Stem Cell Transplantation Program here at Children's Hospital. George, nice to see you again.
Good to see you, Roger.
I'm just thinking that this is the fifth anniversary year of the beginning of CIRM, Prop 71, California Institute of Regenerative Medicine. I think almost the last time we spoke at any length was a year after that at the first scientific meeting of CIRM. And we've just been saying, wow, so much has happened. I mean, do you want to give me some sense for a general audience of the last 5 years and where you think we're going in the next five?
I think the last several years have been the most exciting period of my entire scientific career, and I would imagine they're part of, it's one of the most exciting periods in the history of science. Certainly, if you're interested in stem cells, the big breakthrough has been Shinya Yamanaka's reprogramming. You know, when we first were talking about CIRM, we were talking about nuclear transfer-based reprogramming. We imagined all along people would be searching for other strategies, and we imagined nuclear transfer was going to really be the means to an end, ultimately, which would be the direct manipulation of cell fate. We got there so much faster than we thought. Shinya's major contribution has just allowed us to leapfrog so far ahead. So it's been an enormously exciting time, and it's gathered the momentum of the field in a tremendous way, and CIRM is in a good position to capitalize on that.
It also occurs to me that this year the Lasker Award went to Shinya Yamanaka and John Gurdon, which takes us back to very almost sort of pre-Cambrian times.
Yeah, it was a brilliant recognition of the fact that reprogramming, even though it's very exciting today and it's very hot, has been in the scientific tradition, in the scientific lexicon, for 50 years. Yeah. And it was really Briggs and King early on who worked out nuclear transfer in the frog, and then Gurdon who really brought it into its biological context. And in fact, Gurdon's work has been the foundation for so much of developmental biology for decades. The idea that we, as our cells' genome is laid down at the sort of one cell stage, that classical question of, as the organism develops, what happens to the genome? Is the genome mutable, or is it the information that the genome reads out? And in fact, that's what Gurdon proved, is that as all of our tissues develop, the genome stays fixed, but all of the epigenome is modified. And you can reset that by nuclear transfer. And so Yamanaka is really paying homage to the original observations of Gurdon. And so the fact that they shared the prize is terrific. And I think many of us assume they're going to share another prize sometime in the near future.
Well, the Lasker Awards seem to be pretty good predictors as far as I can figure out. Maria Fair was telling me that they now have 79 predictions. People got Lasker Awards and then went on to get Nobels.
So. Yeah, yeah.
Could you also do a little Idiot's Guide 101 for me to put in context where we now currently are on the previous debates about adult stem cells, embryonic stem cells, big ethical issue, and now the IPS story and how those all go together? And is one become redundant now? Does the work still go ahead in all three areas?
The original debate was around embryonic stem cells. It's well appreciated that the human embryo has a particular precious position in the human society, in American debate. It has a particular religious connotation. The idea that we as a society, though, we have agreed that the value of human reproduction is such that we allow in vitro fertilization. And we have generated hundreds of thousands of embryos. We don't consider them people. We consider them a very valuable and precious way of getting to families. But in the meantime, we've got this cluster of cells in a petri dish, many of which are destined to be discarded as medical waste. And the original debate was, should we toss them away or should we use them for medically valuable research? I think we agreed not without dissension, but we agreed that they were enormously valuable tools for research. Then the second layer of the debate was, those cells are valuable, but they're not matched to any particular disease. They don't reflect the cells of a particular patient. They're generic. So we started to think about creating embryos using nuclear transfer, some call cloning, to be able to have disease-specific and patient-specific stem cells. Now, that's valuable. It's never worked because we don't have easy access to all of the materials for making human nuclear transfer work. Shinya's work allowed us to, in a sense, leap beyond some of those ethical debates because we can now, from simple skin cells, generate what we believe are the functional equivalents, the same cells as the embryo-derived cells. So a lot of the heat of the debate has cooled. But I do believe that there's still an enormous value for studying the earliest human embryos. There are certain questions about the way the embryo develops, the way stem cells are set aside in the embryo, the way chromosomal abnormalities sneak in an early human development and end up causing birth defects and complications. Those are questions that can only be answered with embryos and some embryonic stem cells. So I don't think the debate is completely behind us, and I certainly think the value of embryonic cells is so important that we need to continue to study them.
Okay, now could you also then now tack onto this your latest work and tell me how that fits into the picture?
One of the ambitions of stem cell biology for many, many years has been to create customized stem cells. That is to be able to take a cell from a patient with a particular disease and be able to move that disease into the petri dish. Originally, we thought we'd do that with nuclear transfer, but now we do it in a very facile way with direct reprogramming. We take the Yamanaka factors, we stick them into the skin cells, and lo and behold, we get an embryonic stem cell in a dish. It's called an induced pluripotent stem cell. What this has allowed us to do, because we're very interested in disease, is we've taken a whole range of human conditions and we've put them in the petri dish. So we now have the master stem cells for Huntington disease, muscular dystrophy, diabetes, Parkinson's, Alzheimer's, immune deficiency, a variety of genetic blood diseases that we're particularly interested in. So we have now the ability to model human development. We know a lot of these diseases, neurodegenerative diseases and the like, are actually problems of the development of the brain, the development of the nervous system. By the time a patient shows up with those problems, many times the disease process has run its course. But by having the stem cell in a dish, we can replay the disease process in a way that we can observe it very, very carefully. So disease-specific stem cells give us enormous tools for research. In the long run, we also hope we're going to learn how to make the very cells a patient needs if they are lacking effective dopamine neurons, or if they're lacking insulin-producing beta cells, or if they're lacking the blood stem cells. If we can produce them in a petri dish from a patient's own tissues, repair the genetic defects, think of the regenerative possibilities of that kind of work.
Now, some of the most recent work I've been reading about, papers in October of this year, one of the things you obviously have to do when you're doing that procedure is to make sure you've got the right cells, whether you've got pluripotent cells. How do you assay this? Is this an accurate way? I mean, are we sure that we've got the right things going in here and so on? So this is some of your latest work, isn't it?
We've been very interested in analyzing these stem cells at a very, very fine level to really know whether they're identical to and essentially able to replace the embryonic stem cells. This is a very, very important issue. So from a skin cell, we can make the induced pluripotent stem cell. And we think in certain studies, they're the equivalent of the embryo-derived stem cells. We are now starting to ask at the very, very fine level, are they the same? Also, it turns out when you make these induced pluripotent stem cells, there's greater heterogeneity than I think people are willing to admit. Mm-hmm. The last 3 years, everybody got their paper published by arguing how identical they are to embryonic stem cells. Now you're going to start to see papers that say, well, wait a second, there may be some interesting differences. And, oh, by the way, not every iPS cell is the equivalent of every other iPS cell. So we actually looked at the variety of colony types that are produced when you go through this reprogramming. And it turns out there are a couple of colony types that look very similar. And to the undiscerning eye would be called IPS. We've published on the criteria for ensuring that you have an IPS and that when you call it an IPS, everybody knows what you're speaking about.
Again, this is the induced pluripotent stem cell.
The induced pluripotent stem cell.
Right. Yeah. I'm looking at this piece that also turned up in Nature. I know this is not one of your favorite pieces, and most scientists don't, but this is written in Nature, so you know it's a reasonable scientific journal. It's a piece that's called Fast and Furious, and it's retailing the fact that with the Yamanaka work and then subsequent work, there's just been this explosion of interest in doing this. It's become a growth area. People are competing like crazy about it. I'm not raising this to say that it's bad that scientists are competitive. They are. What I am raising it for is to say, give me some sense, a corrective, if you like, to the public impression of how science is done.
Yeah. So I think the public thinks about scientists as being these sort of nerdy, ascetic individuals who, you know, have thick glasses and not much personality, and they sit at the bench and they work and toil for, you know, late into the night. We have a few of those, and I'm very pleased that they're working very hard. But in fact, science is incredibly creative. Science requires tremendous energy, tremendous passion, and that tends to correlate with competitiveness as well. So it's not necessarily a bad thing. Thousands of folks are now entering this field from different areas. That will create this, you know, cauldron of activity, and it will generate tremendous breakthroughs. So it's a good thing. I think those of us who were kind of involved early on are hopeful that we'll get through this phase of Fast and Furious, and we'll be able to be a little more contemplative, a little more careful about the types of questions we ask. In the long run, it'll mean much better science.
Yeah, I noticed actually, and again, this is not to scare people, but there are many papers now being written on issues like whether P53, protein 53, whether there are stem cells, cancer stem cells, and so on and so forth. There was even, I think, a Newsweek or Time cover on this sort of thing that, okay, it's very wonderful to have these cells that can grow and so on and so forth, but isn't that what's exactly wrong when you have cancer? Mm. And I think people are confused about those sorts of things. Can you just gloss that a bit for me?
Yeah, so studying stem cells are going to teach us not only about questions of human development and tissue formation and regeneration, but it is going to teach us a lot about cancer. But it does lead to some confusion. They say, oh, there's stem cells in cancers, and there's stem cells that you want to use to treat my disease. How do I know if you give me stem cells for my disease, I'm not going to get cancer? And in fact, the biology of the way cells grow is very much the same, whether we're studying stem cells in a cancer or stem cells in normal development. We do need to understand how to keep those issues separate. They cross-fertilize each other intellectually, but fundamentally, they teach us a lot about the same basic processes. In the long run, when we turn stem cells into therapies, we're going to pay very, very careful attention that we reduce the risk of inducing cancer. We can't eliminate that risk entirely, and that will always be there. So it is something we pay an enormous amount of attention to.
I sort of know what your schedule is like, and it's crazy. You're on the road a lot. You're a statesman of science in many ways. You do the work, you publish papers. Did you have any inkling when you first got into this that this is what it was going to be like?
I've wanted to be a scholar, an academic, a researcher, an explorer, I think is fundamentally what it is, since I was very, very young. I always hoped it would be as exciting as it has turned out to be. You know, maybe if I were in the 16th century, I would have been jumping on ships and, you know, going off into the world and trying to find the, you know, the easiest route to India or something. I think, you know, you've got to be driven by the excitement of the search. Also, I'm a physician, so I derive an inspiration and some sense of purpose from actually exploring in areas that might improve human health. It makes it very, very exciting. You work very hard because everybody else is working hard, but it's also very rewarding.
So, did you come from a scientific background? I mean, what's the entrance into all this?
Well, it was funny. You know, when I came to university, I wasn't sure whether I was going to do government or science. I ended up majoring in philosophy early on and thought deeply about ethics. It was an area of tremendous interest, which is fascinating because now that I've and I ultimately went off into science, it's an interesting story on its own. But now I find that my original readings in philosophy have been very important as I've thought about and talked about the way we justify our scientific endeavors.
Yeah. So did you have parents who had any scientific background at all?
My dad was a traveling salesman. My mom was a high school teacher in social science.
But from around here or?
Upstate New York, in Saugerties and Catskill, New York. You know, in some sense, I got the gift of teaching and the ability to sort of communicate from both my dad and my mom. The science came somewhere else.
Well, but you just said that the science itself was an interesting story. You said, and then glossed over. What was the story on?
Well, I had much of this you want to hear about myself, but when I was in high school, I was privileged to have some spectacular science teachers: Ralph Beatty teaching me chemistry and physics, Carl Hoffman teaching me biology. They certainly instilled in me the sense of wonderment of science. Then I went off to university and I got caught up in philosophy and all that, but I needed a job. I needed to work term time. And I washed dishes for my first year and I just thought, this is crazy.
Where were you then?
I was at Harvard University as a freshman washing dishes for all my classmates. And then I realized, you know, I might be able to get a job in a lab washing dishes. That might be a little more interesting. So I started out, you know, washing glassware in a lab and very quickly moved to the bench and ended up finishing a thesis, an undergraduate thesis in biology. And it gave me this sense of purpose and a focus, and it was exciting. It was extremely exciting. And that was it. Launched me on my entire career.
I had a conversation with Tuck Finch, the aide gerontology researcher, and he told me a story about same thing. He got a bursary award and he was washing dishes at Princeton and just got furious and thought, what am I doing washing dishes? And went and asked for it, if there was some other job that he could perform for the requirement.
Yeah.
And they said, well, go to some other department and help out. And he looked through the list and there was this thing that said biophysics. And he said, oh, I'll go there. This was Harold Moravitz had just started the biophysics department, in fact. So that's the genesis of Tuck Finch's entrance into science,
yeah.
real entrance into science.
I suspect that if you talk to a lot of scientists, there are a fair number of us who worked in kitchens, and someone's, you know, it's good work and someone's got to do it. It's just, when I got to university and I realized there were this whole smorgasbord of opportunities in front of me,
yeah.
I certainly needed to work, and I did that for a while and it was fine. But ultimately I was able to find another dishwashing opportunity that put me in an environment of the laboratory that has turned out to be a great gift.
So you've got an MD, PhD?
Yes.
it's a lot of study in there.
It's a long gestational period. There's no doubt about it. And I have to say that I'm often questioning the time that I spent in medicine. Was it time well spent? Because it certainly diverted me from publishing papers and doing science. But in the long run, it's been enormously valuable. I think I ask questions about disease. I ask questions that will have relevance to treatment, to translation. So in many ways, I think the medical training I had has been instrumental to making me the type of scientist that I am.
Now, what were the primary diseases that you got involved in when you specialized?
Well, so very early, I became interested in leukemia and cancers of the blood. And so as a graduate student, I studied chronic myelogenous leukemia, which is not a public health menace. There are only 4,000 or 5,000 new cases in the United States every year. But it had a consistent chromosomal abnormality, the Philadelphia chromosome. And that said to me, this would be a very, very tight link between genes and cancer. And in fact, ultimately, I moved the human gene into a mouse and proved that this human gene, BCR-ABL, causes the disease. And now we have this wonder drug, Gleevec, which was developed in part because it was so clear that if you could inhibit this BCR-ABL, you could cure the disease. And in fact, that's where we are today. That got me interested in blood disease in general, blood stem cells in particular, bone marrow transplantation, stem cell transplantation, and that was my evolution from a focus on the cancer of the blood stem cell, chronic myeloid leukemia, and stem cells more generally.
Yeah. The reason I ask you these questions, which may sound like they're irrelevant personal details, but I meet so many young scientists who are completely baffled about what their trajectory should be. There are two books I always mention. One's Advice to a Young Scientist by Peter Medawar.
Yes.
And the other one, Advice to a Young Investigator by Ramoni Cajal. And they're getting a little bit dated. So I've been asking people, okay, so what was your trajectory and what is your advice to a young scientist? So I ask you the same thing now. If you look at what you did there was a smart choice of problem, for one thing, because that led to something else. And then you see that there's a course that you followed. So
I think the course is unpredictable.
I'm not saying that there was a predefined course.
No, it's not like setting out as an explorer. Well, maybe it is when you're in the 16th century and you don't have GPS and you're setting out as an explorer. Maybe the course is unpredictable. I think what I see, as I've now had this incredible privilege to supervise and mentor another generation of scientists, I've been in it now 15 years, is passion in a problem, getting excited, getting worked up and enthusiastic, willing to work extra hard to solve that problem. That's the core of a good scientist, and that's what I look for when I now meet junior people. So I say, if you're thinking about your trajectory, the trajectory will work itself out in a grand way as long as you're focusing on really, really important problems. You bring passion to those problems and sustained effort. That's what you need. And I have a colleague who adds the killer instinct to that in order to be successful.
Let's go back to the last 5 years in which, and let's say stem cells and the reception of stem cells and the communication of information about stem cells to a larger public is a case study in communication of science.
Yes, yes.
Good job, bad job, improvements you see, how?
Well, I think there's been an enormous amount of attention paid to stem cells over the last decade, largely because the media has shown great interest. I think in general, the media has done a fantastic job. I've met lots of reporters who have had this as a beat and have taken a tremendous interest in it and come, as you have, well, you have a background in science, but many reporters who have no background in science who yet read deeply, voraciously, and come very, very well prepared. And they have been extremely skillful at communicating that information to the public. I think it's been, I think as if the case study is done, it's a good example of how to get information out. Now, that being said, we continue to have challenges. It's difficult. The concepts are difficult. And even scientists sometimes have difficulty keeping up with the pace of advances and interpreting them in this greater social context. So I would say scientists have been drawn out of the laboratory, probably more in this field than in a lot of other fields of science, by the controversy. That's been the kind of the smoldering embers that have continued to make this keep it an interest. So I would say scientists should do more of it than they have. I hope this experience has made more scientists feel comfortable about speaking out, not just to defend their field, but to educate. And ultimately, we depend on the social context. We depend on the society to support what we do in science. And our hope is that what we do will reflect back positively on the society, helping, improving human health and the like.
Yeah, I mean, part of what we do at the Science Network, as you know, is provide information at the intersection between science and social policy. I think that's enormously important. I don't see how you can go make an informed decision about something that the president has on his agenda, like his health bill, if you don't know some of the basic information that needs to go into your decision. So having said that, the Pew Foundation, Pew Center, recently did a survey. They do one each year about scientific literacy.
Yes.
This year they did one in which they asked the general public for its attitudes about science, and also they've got 1,000, I think it was about 1,000 members of the AAAS, American Association for the Advancement of Science, to comment on some similar parallel questions. And you can look at it on the website, but I mean the short story was, public thinks science is a good thing and doesn't know very much and still thinks it's a kind of issue whether the sun goes around the earth or vice versa, and so how old the earth is and so on. Scientists thought public didn't really know much science at all and didn't seem to be very inclined to spend much time telling them about it either. And there were a couple of comments there from people like Alan Leshner saying, we have to change this.
Right. Right.
And I think that's a crucial point that in this field particularly.
I agree. I mean, I think we've had the opportunity, because of the public debate, to feel it incumbent upon us to go out and educate. I think those of us in the stem cell field have done that. I think many of our leaders have been, you know, very, very engaged in giving public addresses and the like, and I think that's been wonderful. I think we have to win people over. There's an awful lot out there competing for our story. I mean, you just go on the web and, you know, how can science compete with, you know, the glitz of Hollywood and the appeal of music and all that? But we have to try to compete in that field of ideas, because it's important. Science is a great message. I spend a lot of time with young people trying to inspire them that they're going to have more satisfaction out of their life if they go into science than, I apologize to my financier friends, but then if they go into investing. Because we need people doing that, but far too many of our really bright young people are being dissuaded from science because they think it's too hard. But in fact, science is incredibly rewarding. And we are becoming more and more science dependent in our society. It's not just healthcare. Everybody appreciates the scientific implications for healthcare. But as we think about global warming, as we think about energy utilization and all of that, it is just putting a greater imperative that we have a scientifically literate public. So I say, yep, it's many, many challenges, as the Pew study has pointed out, but we should take on that challenge because we've got a good product to sell, if you will.
Where's your research going from this point onward? What are you engaged in at this point? Is there anything which has translational, to use the term du jour, the regenerative medicine applications?
Yes.
You're in Children's Hospital.
Yes. I am the director of the stem cell transplantation program here at Children's Hospital, which today is responsible for bone marrow transplantation. So we take 70 to 80 kids a year who have leukemias and various genetic diseases of the bone marrow, and we take them through what we hope is a curative therapy. The problem is that we can't cure all of our kids. And there are applications of cell therapy outside the diseases of the blood. And so what I'm pushing for, and my ambition scientifically, is to be able to make a difference in the treatment of patients. Initially, my interest is in treating genetic and malignant blood diseases better. So we have projects that we're studying various kinds of immune deficiencies, various kinds of diseases where the bone marrow fails or becomes leukemic. Diseases of red blood cells, like sickle cell anemia or thalassemia. My hope is that our work will translate into better treatment for those diseases over the next decade or more. Of course, in the greater context, cells could be thought of for treating diabetes or perhaps liver disease, various metabolic conditions. So working with a network of colleagues here, and we have over 40 laboratories at Children's who are interested in stem cells, our hope is that we will usher in a whole new way of thinking about cells as medicines. So that will be translational.
And as you were speaking about that, that harks back to your very first interest in the blood diseases
as
well. Let me just pick up that point you were making about science earlier as well. In his inaugural address, President Obama said that, and later in a talk that he gave at the National Academies of Sciences, he used the phrase about restoring science to its rightful place. I'd be interested to know, and I've been asking people, what you think the rightful place of science is.
Well, the rightful place is to receive more funding. So I'll say it in a mercenary way if we're talking about the president. And I think he's made an attempt to try to direct more funding for science. But science in a greater sense is an attempt to understand the realities of our physical world. And I think the rightful place is to realize that understanding the way the physical world works, whether it's physics or chemistry or biology, I think should be explored, first of all, in an unfettered, unencumbered way, and in a way that is isn't necessarily directed toward a specific purpose. It's basic science. Fundamental inquiry will teach us things that we can't anticipate. If we were smart enough to know which direction to head, then we wouldn't need all the investment in basic science, but we're not smart enough. So I think science is an attempt at a closer and closer approximation to the truth. The challenges, though, are that we have physical reality and we have spiritual reality. And there's this sense that the two can't necessarily coexist, and I think they can. I think they can and they should. And that scientific investigation should be seen as not an assault on spiritual reality. And all too often it's seen as a tension between the two. The fact that we have Francis Collins, who's a deeply spiritual individual, now running the basic biological science program at the National Institutes of Health as our director, I think hopefully will bring that issue into relief. I think Francis is someone who can articulate how science and spirituality can coexist in a very productive way.
Sounds like I should invite you to the next Beyond Belief. And as you know, we've had these debates going on for 3 or 4 meetings now with, on the one hand, people who've been dubbed the new atheists, basically saying you cannot mix the two, and people saying the opposite, like you or like Francis and so on. So
yeah, I hope that we're not heading towards the argument that you cannot mix the two. I think I've seen too often that we need humility. Science doesn't necessarily address all the questions of philosophy and faith, and so we as scientists need to remain humble. I'm slated to speak on a panel at MIT with the sort of senior cleric of the Episcopal Church. And there's been a strong interest at MIT in the interface of science and religion. Here, the one of the world's epicenters of scientific investigation, and there's still a very, very rich discussion around spirituality and its role in informing our sense of where we stand in the cosmos.
Yeah. So let me ask you a question. I'm curious. If you hadn't gone into science, although the bug bit you very early, is there anything else you could imagine that you might have liked to do, like to be?
Yes. I might be one of two things. I think I'd be very fascinated by architecture. There's something about building and structuring space, which is very satisfying, but it's also very, very creative. And I've always liked that. The notion of marrying kind of the service and creativity of a structure with the intricacies and the engineering principles and the structural principles that one would have to put together. I've always thought architecture would be an interesting area. I think I might also have ended up as like a sommelier or a chef or something, because I like the idea of, you know, serving in the sense of creating an experience. When I go home from the lab, I don't work in the lab anymore. But when I go home, I work in the kitchen. I still do my dishwashing, as it turns out. I just do it after I've created a meal. And
well,
it has the same elements.
All right, here's another question I sometimes ask people. You've set this up perfectly, since you're creating a dinner here. You can have anybody to dinner you want, for anybody from history. Who would you like to have to dinner?
Oh, my gosh. Well, I would certainly, Darwin, Einstein, Christ, Aristotle. I think that would be a pretty good start. Maybe Jackie Robinson as well. Oh my goodness, imagine whom you could have around the table. Gandhi, Confucius, my goodness. I mean, they're remarkable people. I'd love to have Obama around the table. Not to put him in the same light as all of those, I think his, he does for the modern individual, though, represent the kind of intellectual values, the kind of community service-oriented philosophy that I have tremendous respect for. I only hope that all of his promise is ultimately realized, so that 50 years from now we can be thinking of him in the same light as Gandhi and the others.
It's interesting that this philosophy background as well, it seems to be something that you're deeply attached to, and seems to, you feel like it set you in good stead.
It really did. In fact, I'm sad. Last night when I flew back from London, Noam Chomsky was sitting five or six rows ahead of me, and he was one of the early thinkers I read in philosophy, and I actually took a class where he came and lectured. And his remarkable attention to the sort of interface of linguistics and philosophy was in some way what I had hoped I could do in interfacing aspects of epistemology, philosophy, and science. I never quite did that, but I was sorry that he rushed off the plane and we were in a crowd and I didn't actually get to just say hello to him. The fact is that I think some of those early thinkers, Rawls was also a very important influence on me, and I took a seminar where he taught a tutorial. And I think philosophy has an enormous amount to teach us about the rigor of thinking, the dissection of ideas, and not accepting nuance without challenging it. And that's held me in very, very good stead for thinking about science.
You mentioned John Rawls, whose Theory of Justice was a seminal book.
And political liberalism even more important.
Right. There is now a book out, just brand new, by Amartya Sen on justice. Michael Sandel also on.
Yes, Michael Sandel is.
But Amartya's book looks and celebrates Rawls in many ways, but also takes issue with a number of basic points in Rawls. The reason I mention this is that the whole notion of distributive justice and how fairly to do these things. Fairness, justice is fairness, yes, is a fundamental issue that does turn up when I have discussions with people about aging and about healthcare.
Yes.
And there are some people who would argue, in fact, that given all the new gene therapies and so on, that unless you can pay for a lot of these things down the line, there's going to be a health elite.
Yes.
And I bring this back to the stem cell things and here, and you mentioned Rawls, distributive justice.
Right.
Do you see where I'm going with this?
Yes, I do. Yes. I mean, I would say so. I don't know whether to answer that question from a philosopher's perspective, which I'm not, or from the defense of science and medicine. Let me start by saying, I think there's been a tension in classical philosophy, which Rawls certainly represents, the sort of deontologic absolutist focus on basic principles and deriving what is the good life and good practice from core principles, has always been in tension with the kind of utilitarian perspective, where we have to somehow define what's the maximal good and then distribute the maximal good around. And those are the two ends of a constant tension that may never be resolved. I don't accept this argument that stem cells is simply going to be another drive to high technology, expensive medicine that only the rich will be able to take part in. I was part of the task force that established guidelines for the clinical translation of stem cells. We sponsored this through the International Stem Cell Society. We had an entire core component, one quarter of the whole effort, assigned to social justice issues. And we paid great attention to the fact that if stem cell technology doesn't serve the healthcare needs of the entire population, it will not have met with its social justice aims. I think there's no doubt that certain aspects of technology will always be incubated in the wealthy countries who can invest in the research, and they may be the early beneficiaries of that. But I think we are now running a global operation. Science and healthcare is delivered globally. The challenges will always be there of distributing the benefits globally. They will always be there. But at least the intention is true. The intention, I think, of the people, the practitioners of stem cell science, medicine in general, is that it should be for the common good. The fact that I'm at Children's Hospital means that we put a particular emphasis on the young. Because if you can make an intervention in the young, you've saved an entire life. So these issues of life extension and all, which also complicate, what we're really trying to do is improve human health. And ultimately, and we're measuring this 100 years from now, it's got to be improving human health for all, not just for the few who can afford it.
One of the other programs we do is one called Brains Are Us, the Science of Educating. And it's all about the whole dynamic of and the information that goes into it. We happen to be talking about timing from cellular level all the way to the schoolroom. But there's a more fundamental point here about how education, how science education is done. And Natalie Angier, in her book, The Canon, says, and she quotes Peter Galistel, who's in town here, saying, how is it that we manage to take these bright, bouncy little things and beat them into a state where they have no interest in doing so? How do we manage to do that?
I know.
So plainly there's a way of, there has to be a way of teaching science that's more effective. There's a growth of science festivals, I've noticed.
Yes.
There's one here in Boston, Larry Box starting one in Washington. I have found that teaching people the history of science, just some of the wonderful characters
is meant.
But you've got kids who are at this age now. What's your experience of this?
Well, I think that you've got to tell them the stories that get them excited. I mean, kids are wonderful listeners, and they want to hear why, you know, working on stem cells is exciting. And I've done that to them. And my kids know, you know, when their teacher, my little son came home from kindergarten, and the teacher had asked him, you know, what does your father do? And my son's quote was, well, my father studies stem cells so that people will live. You know, it's like, he sort of captured it. You know, he got it. He knew that there was something there. So you have to get kids excited, you know, and that's partly getting them into it. And our kids take Russian math. There's a local school here that was started by a Russian emigre years ago who was a math teacher. And she's established an entire curriculum for young kids. And now she has all these, you know, acolytes. There are all these other Russian women who teach our kids math. And I go once a year and I sit in on class, and it's fabulous because the teachers are excited. They barely speak English. They emphasize thinking. Math is about thinking, concepts, problem solving. It's not about, you know, learning your equations. And my kids come home and they're excited about it. They think of their puzzles. It's fun. Science is about putting a puzzle together fundamentally. And you got to make that fun from a very, very early age.
In terms of not understanding fundamental science, this is all part of the same story. Not understanding fundamental science and being scared can lead you to looking in the yellow pages and trying to find a stem cell clinic. Now, and this is not a joke. I mean, here's a paper from correspondence in Cell magazine, right. Stem cell clinics
is that
online.
Tim Caulfield's
the direct
paper?
Direct consumer. Yes, Tim
Caulfield. Yeah.
Portrait of stem cell medicine.
Yeah.
What is going on? What do we mean? Careful about.
Yeah, this is very frightening. So, I have a stack of correspondence in my office, 5 inches thick, from desperate patients, all of whom are reaching out for the stem cell cure. And most of them are interested enough to at least inquire about whether or not this is going to work. But what I read in all of those is the desperation, the need. The fact is that everyone at one time or another in their life, either themselves or their loved ones, will face their mortality, will face the challenges of the ravages of disease or what have you. It's particularly painful when it hits a loved one, when it hits a young child, and we see all of that need. So where do patients go? They go to Google, and they'll Google stem cell treatments, and they'll get a whole series of sponsored sites, and they'll click on these sites, and the sites, as recounted in this paper, overpromise and hype what they can offer. And then, oh, by the way, they charge tens of thousands of dollars to do this. This is the downside of all of the promise of stem cells, which has been announced and glorified in the media. Yes, the promise is there, and it's enormously exciting, but people have to appreciate the difference between the foundations of basic science as a pedestal for the treatments of tomorrow, because that transition takes decades. And we're at the foundations right now, and I'm very confident that 50 years in the future, we're going to look back to stem cells and be able to point to all the ways stem cells have led to cures. Mm-hmm. But to take it to the entrepreneur now, and you know that's generous to call these folks who are hawking what is snake oil. I mean, this has been a tradition throughout history that people are in need and someone is there to sell them what they need. The fact is, unfortunately, outside of the blood, we don't have cures in stem cells. We're working on them, but we're not there today.
So caveat emptor.
Absolutely, caveat emptor.
One final question. What are you optimistic about?
I have to tell you a story to answer that question.
Okay.
I'm optimistic about the future leaders of our world, not just scientific leaders. I've been a speaker for the last 2 years at something called the Novartis International Leadership BioCamp. So I spoke in Hong Kong last year and just last week here in Cambridge. This is an effort by Novartis to identify through local competitions the folks they think are going to be the leaders of tomorrow in biotechnology. Many of them have backgrounds in science, but some are attorneys, some are doctors, and the like. Hmm. And they were all brought together. And they are from Pakistan, Malaysia, Russia, Romania. They're from all over the world, not just the United States. In fact, they're mostly represented in developing countries. And the spirit and the brilliance and the ambition and the enthusiasm of that group has been an inspiration to me. I'm optimistic because even though they're from disparate parts of the world with lots of political tensions, they all come together with the same common passion, which is that we are one. We are one as a people on Earth. We need to move towards better use of energy. We need to move towards more universal healthcare delivery. The fact that our future is in the hands of those leaders gives me great, great optimism.
George Zeddy, thanks very much.
Thank you.